We're talking about rural school district enrollment declines here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. A decline in the number of children in an area can pose real financial hardship for rural communities. Enrollment can often dictate the amount of state support a school district receives and the amount of money the school district is able to raise from property taxes. So if enrollment goes down, so too does the district's budget. And in parts of northern and central Wisconsin, the number of children is expected to decline by up to a quarter over the next couple decades. Do you teach in a rural school? How is your school faring? Have you been affected by a school closing, and how do you deal with it? We're at 800-642-1234. Kim Kokel is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Rural Schools Alliance. Kim, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning, and thank you for having me, Kate. Appreciate it.
So we see those three schools closing within the Unified Anago School District. They aren't consolidating, they're downsizing. So explain for us what's going on there.
It's a kind of a phenomenon that's been going on for the last probably 5 to 10 years at probably a higher rate than maybe it had in the past. And many school districts are having to make very tough decisions with some of their outlying elementary schools. It's usually elementaries that are affected because those are usually out in the outlying areas. To meet the needs of their community and their students, and to continue to provide, quality. Quality programs for their students. And sometimes it comes down to, do you start cutting quality programs or do you close a building because of declining enrollment in certain areas? And you know, the problem you get with declining enrollment is, you know, it doesn't affect just, you know, like a number, like an Anago, we'll use that as an example because that's who we're talking about. They've lost about 250 students over the since 2008. And unfortunately, when you look at those numbers, you know, well, you say 250 students, well, you know, it's probably, you know, 5 to 6 students in grade 1, 5 to 6 students in grade 4. And so it's not even across the board there, and makes it very difficult when it comes to staffing and things like that. And some districts, you know, have tried to stem the tide of closing the buildings by maybe just moving certain grades to fill a grade in another area. But that, to a point, that becomes a logistical nightmare. And then you have to come to that point where you make the tough decision of possibly closing an outlying elementary. And, you know, and again, in Anago's case, this is their fourth elementary that they've closed. In 2016, they closed Montoon. And it's something you're seeing across the state. And it's just, it comes down to tight budgets, declining enrollment, people moving, you know, and the declining enrollment's coming because people are moving away because there's not the jobs that there used to be out in the rural areas. It just becomes kind of this downward cycle.
Yeah, it sounds like you're describing a domino effect, if you will.
Yes.
So how does this type of downsizing impact staff and students?
Well, in many cases, the staffing side of it, what many districts try to do is, you know, when they look at closings, is look at, okay, you know, are there retirements coming up that maybe will help absorb some of the hits, so you're not having to lay off teachers, and you can just move them to a different one of the different buildings, because numbers will increase in certain buildings also, when you make these closures. And so the number of kids are still going to probably, total number of kids are still going to be there. They're going to be all in one building now. So what you may be able to do is you're not going to lay off all those teachers that in one of those buildings that's closed, because you're going to need them because the numbers are going to increase elsewhere. But it will impact some staff. And that's where you look at, okay, are there possible retirements coming up where you can kind of absorb that hit and not have to lay somebody off?
Yeah, look at attrition there. Talking about the challenges of rural school districts with Kim Kokel, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Rural Schools Alliance. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Do you work at a rural school? What is your role and what issues does your school face? What is it like to go to referendum and what happened there? We're at 800-642-1234. 202-1234 email ideas at WPR.org. So as we look at Anago and other school districts, Kim, what happens to these buildings after a school closes them or consolidates or no longer uses these outlying elementary school buildings? What happens to them?
At first, it really causes a lot of strife in those communities, and, you know, rightfully so, because they're losing their building. But, you know, what we try to explain to folks is, you know, you have to look at the bigger picture that that building is broken, you know, bricks and mortar, but you want to continue, as I said earlier, you know, provide quality programs for your students so they can compete, you know, against our urban and suburban counterparts. So what many districts have looked at, or many of those communities have looked at, is how do they repurpose those buildings? Many times they become a community center, a senior center. I've got up north, there's a couple districts that have gone together with an elementary up there to go in cooperation with a technical college, you know, to build a job center and a CTE center, which is Career and Technical Education Center, for these four districts. Which allows their students to come to one location and get quality CTE education. You know, like I said, there's all kinds of things that can be done with those buildings. You know, a lot depends on, you know, the leadership in those communities where those buildings have closed, you know, to try to make, you know, positive things happen with those buildings. You know, and unfortunately, sometimes, you know, they do set their empty and do become a nuisance. But, you know, many times people are very creative and have come up with some really good uses for the community, for those buildings, which in turn sometimes, you know, depending on what they've done with the building, may be, a positive for the community.
A positive economic development impact on that community.
Correct.
Let's take a closer look now at this declining enrollment situation. We're seeing in recent years, 59% of Wisconsin school districts are experiencing enrollment decline. What is going on here?
Well, I think I mentioned a little bit earlier. You know, one of the things that I really discussed with the Blue Ribbon Commission when they were going around the state is, we need to look at rural economic development. You know, there used to be a lot of businesses and things out in the rural areas, but many of them, due to logistics or workforce or downsizing, have closed their rural areas and moved everything and centralized to the urban, suburban, kind of like what school districts do, you know, have had to do as budgets have changed and things like that. And so with that lack of jobs, you have people moving out to where the jobs are. And if we could find a way to, you know, infuse some rural economic development, there's still a very solid workforce out in our rural areas that could help stem this tide of declining enrollment. I think the other thing that we have to look at, too, is, you know, much smaller families. You know, rural families used to be very large families because of the farming communities and things like that. You're not seeing that as much as you used to.
And what about broadband issues? Is that an issue for rural communities being connected?
Yes, it is. It's better than it was, and it's continuing to improve. And I would say for the majority of our school districts and public libraries in our rural communities, the broadband isn't as much of an issue. Mm. Unfortunately, the issue becomes then when kids go home. You know, if there's online homework, things like that, they don't have, you know, there's many areas that are still dial-up, you know, so it's very slow speed. And one of the things that, you know, some districts have tried, and it's been working pretty well through some pilot programs, is hotspots on their school buses.
We're going to pause right there with Kim Kokel. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Rural Schools Alliance. Are you a school bus driver in rural Wisconsin? What school district are you a part of, and how long is a typical bus route for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about rural school district challenges here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Communities in rural areas with declining numbers of kids often have difficulty providing enough resources for their school districts. They may struggle with the cost of transporting students across a sprawling area. The Anago School District is making some big changes. It's consolidating students into fewer school buildings in response to enrollment declines of more than 20% over the past couple decades. What issues does your rural school face? Have you had to go to referendum, and what was the outcome? Did you graduate from a rural school here in Wisconsin? How would you describe your experience? Join in at 800-642-1234. Kim Kokel stays with us. He heads up the Wisconsin Rural Schools Alliance. Kim, let's look at budget situations for rural schools. The most recent budget includes a $500 million increase in funding for schools over a period of 2 years. Do you feel this budget that is being put together by the legislature and Governor Evers is putting school funding back on track where it needs to be?
Well, the proposed budget right now is, again, you know, a step in a positive direction, but it's still falling short of many of the needs of our school districts. And, you know, what we have to look at is, you know, the last budget, the 17-18 biennial budget, really only caught us back up to, you know, it was a nice jump for the education community, but it only brought us back to about 2011 funding. So it's still, we were behind the inflation scale there. And even this present budget that's being proposed by the Joint Finance Committee that's going to the floor this week, we're about 0.5% behind of inflation there. So we're still going to be behind. So many of our rural districts are going to still struggle, and you're going to probably see, you know, many referendums still out there for operational expenses.
Well, let's...
Go ahead.
Well, I want to talk about referendums. The Wisconsin Policy Forum put numbers together on school referendums in last November's election. And that's, you know, when school districts ask taxpayers for school facilities and programming and increase their property taxes. And all told, 61 school districts in the state requested nearly $1.5 billion through referendums. How has this impacted rural schools referendums?
Well, I think the positive side of it is that many of our rural districts are very strong supporters of public education. And as you probably have seen in that report, you know, we're passing those at about an 80% rate. The unfortunate side of it is if the state funding doesn't improve, you know, at a better clip than it has been and get us caught up with inflation, you know, there's only so many times you can go back to your voters and ask for more. And that's where, you know, we need to, you know, look at the state funding side of things and get back to the appropriate funding that they should be providing for our districts. You know, one of the areas in this last budget that Governor Evers had pushed for was increasing the special ed funding because of the impact that it is having on many of our rural schools and both our urban and suburban counterparts also. And, you know, many of our districts right now, because the state is not appropriately funding the special ed side of things, and it hasn't improved since 2008, the funding has been frozen at 25%. Many of our districts are having to take anywhere from, you know, 15 to 25% of their general fund and to offset their and move it over to their special ed funds to offset those costs because of the needs there. And again, we don't want to be pitting our, you know, regular needs students and our special needs students against each other. But, you know, the reality is that then there's these shifts in the budget that do have an overall, again, kind of that domino effect on our overall budget. And so, you know, what we've been looking for is a, you know, we supported Governor Evers's
budget
recommendation
proposal.
Recommendation of 30% in the first year and 60% in the second year. And the Joint Finance Committee proposal that's going to the floor right now is at 1%, which would get us to 26 in the first year and then 30%, up to 30% in the second year. Again, steps in the right direction because we've been frozen since 2008. But still is going to not be a big enough impact to help many of our districts. So that, you know, that overall budget state funding has really had an impact on us. And you know, that kind of goes back to why many of these, you know, outlying buildings have had to be closed too. You know, it's not just declining enrollment, lack of jobs, but it's also that budget cycle too.
We're talking with Kim Kokel, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Rural Schools Alliance. You can join in this conversation. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Have you been impacted by a rural school closing? What happened and how did you deal with the situation? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Kim, let's look at, we talked about schools closing and the issue around attrition and phasing out some jobs in rural areas, but you still, on the other hand, have to attract good teachers for the jobs that you do need to fill. When you look at Wisconsin, several states facing a teacher shortage, how is hiring and retaining teachers in rural schools? What is that like?
It's become more and more difficult. When I retired as a high school principal in 2015, you know, I started looking at, you know, hiring trends and things like that from when I first started. And, you know, I remember the days where, you know, I'm going to use social studies for an example. If I had an opening in a rural district, and many of the districts that I worked in as an administrator were rural districts, you know, it was not uncommon to get 100, 125 applicants for a social studies position. My last social studies position, I believe it was in 2013, I believe I had 10, you know, and so, yeah, you know, and I, you know, I'm talking to a lot of my superintendents that I work with on a regular basis. It's very difficult, especially out in the rural areas, you know, to attract quality educators to come out to the rural areas. Number one, because our pay scale is not as high as probably the urban and suburbans. And, you know, our benefits packages aren't as strong as they used to be. You know, back when I first started, we could compete with our urban and suburban counterparts because of the benefit packages that we could offer. Maybe less salary, but, you know, very solid, you know, benefit packages. But when Act 10 came through in 2011, that had a drastic impact on how we could use those benefit packages, you know, with our new hires.
Yeah, so talking Act 10 and collective bargaining, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, a few quick examples here is, especially in special education, we had a study done, and I know up in the northern part of the state, about 65% of our special needs teachers right now are on emergency licensures. And what that means is many of them were, you know, licensed teachers, but they didn't have their special ed certification, so they're going back to get that right now under an emergency licensure. And I've got a number of districts that, you know, haven't even been able to fill certain positions. And over in the western side of the state, because of the career technical education, there's such a shortage of those folks. But I've got four districts over there right now that have gone to a common schedule between all four of them and are busing students to each of the different buildings for certain CTE classes because they couldn't find quality people. And so they decided to join forces, and they're having some good success with it.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to Marty in Palmyra. Hi, Marty.
Good morning. You know, it's correct me if I'm wrong, but people that have children, isn't a good school something that's going to attract them to a neighborhood? Why not put the money toward, you know, up in schools and then increase your population and then your tax base and et cetera, et cetera?
Marty, thanks for the call. Kim, what about that approach of building up from schools to create neighborhoods?
I'm a firm believer in that. And, that, you know, I believe that's something that we constantly try to do. But again, you know, if the budget numbers aren't there to help us with that, you know, it makes it a very difficult situation. I believe our rural school districts do a very good job. Sometimes I think we're our own worst enemy, you know, because we do find creative ways, like I mentioned just now, you know, with four school districts going together because they couldn't find quality educators. And again, to attract people, as Marty just brought up, to attract people, you want quality programs and quality educators. And so what these four districts did is, okay, this is our best solution. Is it costing them some extra in transportation? Yes, it is. Are they getting any extra reimbursement for that transportation? It's pretty minimal.
Well, I want to,
you know, it's kind of this push and pull, but I fully agree. I mean, part of the reason, you know, many people and many businesses move to areas is because of the type of school that is there.
We run out of time, Kim, I want to just quickly look at transportation. A student may have to ride the bus longer, an hour or more in some cases, when school districts consolidate. Mm-hmm. So what are these cost pressures going on in transportation when schools do consolidate?
It's big. You know, I mean, let's just take Antigo, for example. I mean, that's 540 square miles. And so if they would decide to consolidate with another district, you're going to have kids on the buses for a long, long time. And when you get far up north, many of our budgets, school district budgets up there, you know, the transportation is one of their major costs because of the square miles that they go. But even down here in the southern part of the state, the district that I live in, 30 miles west of Madison, River Valley, is 300 square miles. And so
Yeah, we have to stop it there. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Kim Kokol, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Rural Schools Alliance. Coming up, students at a small charter school in Monona spent the past year finding their voice in radio with the help of WPR. We'll take stock of what they learned and where they go from here. That's after a news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about what happens when students push record and learn about making great radio. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. WPR's Wisconsin Life teamed up with a school in Monona last year, visiting the classroom dozens of times and helping students through the process of producing their stories. And we're going to hear some of the finished products with your insights on how you've incorporated storytelling projects in your own classroom and maybe in your own life. The number to join in, 800-642-1234. Maureen McCollum is the host and producer of Wisconsin Life, and she made frequent visits to Monona Grove Liberal Arts Charter School, or MG21, as they call it, over the past year. Maureen, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
And Ian Lowe is here. He is a teacher at the school and co-host of Classroom Frequency. That's the series MG21 produced with Wisconsin Life. Ian, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Maureen, you worked on this project over the course of the school year. How was this collaboration started? Where did it come from?
Well, when I started working on Wisconsin Life, one of the things I wanted to do was find a way to incorporate more younger voices on our program. So I had a connection with MG21. We started talking and decided that it could be a fun thing for me to come into the classroom and work with some of the students, teach them how to create radio. So as you know, that takes, learning how to hold a microphone correctly, learning how to ask proper questions when you're interviewing someone, how to edit audio. And it started out in working with one of Ian's classes, the Voices class, which he'll talk about. And then as the year progressed, there was a group of six students who really wanted to focus on radio itself. And those are the main voices that you hear in the Classroom Frequency program.
And so you visited the school dozens of times through the year, and you were checking in on these students, giving them assignments along the way.
Yeah, about two-thirds of the school year, I was there once a week working with those six students in particular. At the beginning of the school year, I was working with about 25 students.
How does this fit in, Ian, with project-based learning and what you want the students to accomplish?
MG21 is a project-based school, and what that means is that the way that we create space for students to show their learning is perhaps different from traditional schools, and so there's not a lot of standardized test-taking or filling in bubbles on a worksheet. We want to give students the opportunity to have more choice in terms of what they're going to learn, how they're going to go about learning it, and then how they're going to show their learning. And so this project is just a great example of kind of thinking outside the box in terms of how can students demonstrate what they're learning in really creative ways and actually have their learning kind of impact their community.
So did the project, this Voices project, did it come out as a result of working with Wisconsin Life, or did you already have this going?
Well, Maureen and I had met at the beginning of the school year to talk about what what this project could look like. And we didn't know, she and I really didn't know exactly what would come of it. Mm-hmm. We wanted to come in and have Maureen talk to our students and share some examples of radio stories that they might have heard online or podcast episodes and that sort of thing. But then we wanted to give students the opportunity to think about, okay, now that you've heard this and you have an idea of what making a radio piece might be like, what do you want to say and how do you want to go about saying it? And so that's kind of how this came to be. We really didn't know what the final outcome was going to be, and that fits with project-based learning a lot of times.
That was really important to me, to make sure that the students guided the stories that they did. Of course, we had to hold their hands and sort of steer them in the right direction at times, but we really, really wanted for each of the students to choose and really focus on the stories that they wanted to do. We didn't want to have to tell them what to write about or what to think about.
Teasing out those real personal things in their lives and saying that, you know, you have a voice here, your opinion matters. It was that difficult to do and to really establish that trust?
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, maybe at first, but I felt like as the school year went on, the students really opened up to me. I mean, Ian has a different relationship with them because he's with them 5 days a week, 7-8 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And I was only popping in once a week. Mm-hmm. But no, I feel like these students, they're amazing people and they're very kind, caring, thoughtful students. So I think, you know, I mean, it's with any relationship. Over time, they just slowly opened up.
We're talking about a WPR project that cultivated more youth voices in radio. Maureen McCollum is producer of Wisconsin Life. Ian Lowe is a teacher at Monona Grove Liberal Arts Charter School, co-hosted Classroom Frequency, the series his students produced with Wisconsin Life. You can join in. Have you ever told a story or made a piece of art or music that changed you? How did it go? Have you ever interviewed your family members or friends or someone you looked up to? What was that like? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So let's hear from some of the students' work, Maureen. Here's an excerpt from a piece by Sierra Reeder about her brother. What do we know?
So Sierra was one of those students who she had a lot of ideas for the radio project. And
that's what we like.
Oh, yeah, no, I loved it. And you know, she had talked about doing pieces on school lockdowns. She wanted to focus on interviewing like her fellow classmates about what MG21 means to them. But I thought for her, it could be easy just to interview her family members, you know, kind of a StoryCorps type interview. That's a really great place to start if you want to get into radio. And so she decided to do a piece on her brother, Thomas. She wanted to interview her mom and her grandma and her other family members about Thomas. So to get to know Thomas a little better, I went to her house and met him. So I think that's what we'll hear.
You want to grab your stick, bub?
Yes.
Oh, shoot.
Oh, shoot.
Do you like watching movies?
Yeah.
What's your favorite thing to eat?
Gosh, your fire will be.
Grilled cheese, fries, and what?
Root beer.
I decided to do my brother because I love him. My brother has Down syndrome and how that affects, like, our family and how he's not really different from, like, anyone else, but at the same time, he is. I don't know. My brother's just an interesting person, so I was like, why not do the interesting person in my life?
Do you remember the feelings you had when you were told that Thomas had Down syndrome?
I probably didn't have any real feelings. I just thought, okay, what can we do for him to make his life better?
What are some of the best memories that you've had with Thomas?
When we're in the car and he puts in the CD, and right now, today, it's Johnny Mathis, a Christmas CD. Songs each time he gets in the car, 365 days out of the year. I love it.
Why do you love Thomas so much?
He's made my life fuller, and he's never angry. Doesn't matter what, generally he does not hold a grudge. For that reason alone, I love him.
Yeah, so that was Sierra interviewing her grandmother, Shirley, about Thomas. And if you listen to the whole story, which you can find on Wisconsin Life's website, you'll also hear Sierra talking more about Thomas, and she interviews her mom about Thomas. It's a very sweet and touching story.
Yeah, Ian, what did you hear there?
I mean, I heard, you know, love and courage, and that's one of the things that shines through with our students. And so I've listened to that story in so many of them so many times now, but I still get goosebumps listening to it because, you know, I think about when I was in high school, and I, you know, it takes a lot of courage to be able to tell your story. And it's interesting, and this kind of fits with the theme of the Voices class, but on a mural that Sierra actually painted on the wall in my classroom, students often paint stuff on our walls. That's part of project-based learning. Is speak your truth, even if your voice shakes. And that quote, and I don't know who said it originally, but it, Sierra painted it on the wall in the classroom, really gets to the heart at what the class is about, is having the courage to speak your truth, even when it's hard, even when your voice shakes. So it's fitting, perhaps, that we heard Sierra's story first.
Did Sierra, was she reflective of what other students in your class talked about? Did they tell personal stories about their families? Did they open up that way?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And I think that when students see each other being vulnerable, it makes it more likely that others want to say it. Because, you know, there's a hunger to talk about who you are and where you come from, but it's hard to be the first one to put your foot forward. And so as students started to do that and started to share stories, even stories that didn't show up online or on air, just in terms of conversations that we had as a class, it creates a culture of vulnerability and openness and honesty that can be really powerful. And I think it led to some really incredible projects like the one we just heard.
Mm-hmm. Curious, Maureen, with Sierra there, and this is kind of clunky in the weeds radio production, but did you have them write out some scripts and guide that, or did they just figure that out as to what they're going to say in terms of the narration?
She totally figured that out. So one thing that I love about the interview she did, and you didn't hear it in that clip, but as she sat down to interview her grandmother and her mom, she set up the interview so perfectly. So she would say, "I'm Sierra Reederer, and I'm here with my grandmother, Shirley, and we're in her kitchen, and we're about to talk about my brother, Thomas, what we love about him, what comes hard for him." And I'm like, wow, I should set up every interview that way.
She frames
I'm learning
this.
From her. Right. But in that clip where you'll hear the Christmas music, she actually edited that music in herself. And it only took her like one afternoon to figure it out. It was amazing.
That is amazing. Yeah. That is so cool. The series is called High Frequency, and students at Monona Grove Liberal Arts Charter School created more than a dozen pieces over the course of the school year on a variety of topics, some deeply personal, like a brother who has Down syndrome, like divorce. WPR's Wisconsin Life producer Maureen McCollum spearheaded the project. Teacher Ian Lowe co-hosted the project. Have you ever interviewed your family members or friends or someone you looked up to? What was that like? What is it that you expected? Or did it surprise you? Have you incorporated storytelling projects in your classroom? What was the result? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about a Monona Charter School's journey through storytelling and producing these wonderful radio pieces. The series with Wisconsin Life is called Classroom Frequency. The students learned about the value of listening, and they were empowered to find their own voice through storytelling. Have you ever done StoryCorps, where you've sat down and interviewed a family member or friend, perhaps at Thanksgiving? What was that experience like? How did it change you? What is the value of young people telling their stories and finding their voice? Join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. WPR's Maureen McCollum is producer of Wisconsin Life, and Ian Lowe is a teacher at Monona Grove Liberal Arts Charter School. He co-hosted the series called Classroom Frequency. So let's, Maureen, hear another excerpt here, another clip from a budding poet this time. This is the work of Coyote Johnson.
Yeah, Coyote's a sophomore, and she is extremely creative. She writes music, she plays guitar, she writes poetry. Anything else you want to add about Coyote?
She loves to read, so you recommend her a book. She'll read anything that you put in front of her. So, yeah, like you said, just a really creative person who this project fit really well with.
Yeah. And so she recorded a series of poems for us. And since, you know, poems can be long, they can be really short, we just compiled four of her poems. A longer one aired elsewhere in the show. But, yeah, let's go ahead and listen to one of the poems from Coyote.
That smell. This smell brings me back to sleepy mornings in your car with gummy treats you purchased for me from Walmart. It was my reliable breakfast for so long I took advantage that was wrong. You're worth more than gummy bears and Twizzler hairs and every other gummy breakfast we had in your comfy car chairs.
Oh, I want to hear more.
I know. Well, you should definitely check out more. She had another poem called Shoes Without Holes that aired later in the program, like I was saying before, but it deals with family separation, and it will just tear your heart apart.
Mm. In terms of poetry, Ian, does that help? Do you see that helping students cope with issues in their personal life?
Absolutely. I mean, we talk to students a lot, and a lot of students come to this themselves, but being able to write out your feelings or just kind of write out things that are going on for you can be a really healthy thing for students to do. And I think as a young teenager, you know, growing up, there's a lot that is hard, that can be hard. There's a lot of exciting stuff, but there's a lot that's hard. And so students try to navigate that, and writing has become a really healthy outlet. And poetry in particular, you know, I don't have a background in writing poetry a lot myself, but I do use that as an invitation early on in the school year, often in voices classes, to tell a piece of your story, and you know, that's less intimidating than writing a 5-paragraph essay in September. And so that's been a part of the voices class that just kind of gets the wheels turning.
We have this another excerpt here from a student named Harrison Farnham. And Ian, can you tell us about Harrison's work?
Harrison loves history, political and military history. I often joke, and I really enjoy this, that sometimes when I sit down with him to talk about his project ideas or about the projects he's creating, I feel like I'm talking to my old history professors. I majored in history and love history. And so I feel like when I sit down and talk with him, it's like I'm talking with a history professor.
Old soul.
Yes,
oh, yeah.
Absolutely. He's got a bunch of old early 20th century military helmets on his desk to decorate his desk. He collects these things. And so he just loves history and was so excited about the opportunity to explore that passion for history in this project.
So he sat down with a Vietnam veteran. Is that right?
That's correct. Harrison loves to go to like message boards and talk online with just people from around the world about just early military history. And so we had the idea to maybe connect him in person with a Dane County veteran. And through one of the substitute teachers at MG21, he had a buddy who formerly worked at the vet center. This man's name is Bob Cook. He's lived in Dane County for a long time. And they talked for about 45 minutes about Vietnam. And it was the first time Harrison had interviewed anyone in person. And I think it went really well.
Yeah, Harrison said to me afterwards that it's the highlight probably of his high school career. He found it to be such an incredible experience.
So you served in Vietnam. Would you like to say what province or provinces you served in?
I served in 2 Corps in Pleiku and with the 71st Evac Hospital. I was, at that time, I had got a branch transfer from the infantry to Medical Service Corps. I'm probably here today because that branch transfer went through. and this is 65, 1966, and everybody and their brother was going to Vietnam, no matter what we tried to do to avoid it.
What was going home like?
Going home was a mixed bag in some ways. You were anxiously wanting to get out of there and not be killed walking to the plane, which did happen to folks. And there's always the issue of it's kind of like a team and you're leaving the team, and out in the field guys work together as a team and served in that kind of capacity, knowing that what they did out there was critical in keeping each other alive. This is tough. They didn't deserve the treatment they got coming home. That's all.
Thank you very much. That was Bob Cook, a Vietnam veteran.
You could hear in Harrison's voice how careful he was and respectful he was of the veteran Bob Cook. And that's not something that you have to learn over time, I think.
Yeah, and we had a conversation before his interview with Bob, just telling him that sometimes interviews with veterans, you have to be sensitive. So, you know, you hear it in the ways that Harrison asked questions, like, we didn't hear it in that clip, but he asked,
would you like to say?
Or you had friends that served in the infantry. If you wouldn't mind, can you talk about what happened to them? So he was very thoughtful in the way he framed questions, because I said, sometimes people don't want to talk about issues that they've gone through. And he was really sensitive to that. And it was so sweet talking with Harrison afterwards and how he was even talking about how he would improve the way he interviewed people next time in ways that I didn't even have to bring up, like, you know, writing a list of questions. Because Harrison is so smart, he was able to just rattle everything off the top of his head.
Oh, my goodness. Ian, will there be a next time? What do you do next with these students?
Well, I mean, I think that now we have this incredible template and example to show future students about what they can do with radio. And we might not do a year-long project like we did this year, but this is a new way to incorporate. It's a new facet of project-based learning. Now a radio piece can be a way that students decide to demonstrate their learning. And so we'll show these as an example. But I know, you know, Harrison will be in Coyote and Sierra will all be students again next year. And so I wouldn't be surprised if they want to do a radio piece next year. And Maureen will come on in and help, you know, whenever she can.
Well, yeah. There's also the ability of those students, you know, giving their knowledge, what they learn, to the new students coming in.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the best things. And I've been able to kind of guide Ian through the year, too, on how to best teach these things. And as much as I would love to keep going in once a week, you know, it kind of becomes a second full-time job, one that I absolutely love. But, I definitely want to keep the relationship going and make sure that we continue hearing stories from folks like Coyote, Harrison, and Sierra.
Yeah.
And maybe Ian one day.
Yeah. Well, I did take you up on the thought of doing my own StoryCorps-style story where I have this drive home from Iowa City and I interviewed my grandma and just pushed play and just had a conversation with my grandma on the way home, which meant a lot to me. And it helped me. It's important that teachers, I think, put themselves into the project that they ask students to do. And so doing that in a conversation that I had with my grandma was really special and powerful.
Oh, and that makes you look, you're vulnerable as well. You're right there with the students, you know, through that journey.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, this has been so much fun. Maureen, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Kate.
And Ian, thank you.
Thank you for
the time. Maureen McCollum is a host and producer of Wisconsin Life. Ian Lowe is a teacher at Monona Grove Liberal Arts Charter School. He co-hosted Classroom Frequency. That's a series his students produced with Maureen and Wisconsin Life. And you can find this whole series, 19 pieces in all, Maureen and I counted yesterday, at wisconsinlife.org. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.